Good afternoon, Shabbat Shalom. The opening prayer you heard talked about trees, as you might have suspected, because a few days ago was the 15th day of the 11th month, Tu Bishvat, Hamisha Asar Bishvat, the new year of the trees. But you know, this year is a sabbatical year in the Holy Land, and so we didn't have tree planting ceremonies. This is a year to let the land rest. And I know that some of you listening to me now are honoring this year by reading through the Pentateuch. And I'll have more to say about that at the end of this talk. I'm speaking to you from Central Florida. I wish you well wherever you are on this Sabbath day in the winter season. But of course, winters in Florida are not what winters are in some other parts of the world. You know, there's a town in Southern California where I used to spend a lot of time called Azusa. And they used to joke about that town, Azusa. It has everything from A to Z in the USA. Well, now I can say that the Church of Christian Commandment Keepers goes all the way from A to Z, or more appropriately, maybe from A to Z. We go all the way from America to Zimbabwe. So greetings to those of you listening in Zimbabwe. Welcome aboard. And greetings to those of you listening in Duarte, California, wherever you are. And I'm very glad to report I have been hearing about rain in the northern part of California. I've also heard that the Lake Havasu area is considered out of the drought. I've had some wonderful times in that area, Lake Havasu. But I understand that in northern California it's been raining and will continue, and I'm so grateful, so happy to report that. In keeping with the trees theme, I want to talk about roots today. And so today I'm talking about some matriarchs and patriarchs. That's what I want to talk about today. I want to talk about the roots of the church. I want to go back into the history of the church and mention some names, notable ones, the founding parents, you know, founding fathers and mothers of the church in the first century. As the New Testament church arises, the church of the new covenant. And, we have a tradition. I realize that courtesy is beginning to change and manners are beginning to change somewhat, but I think some of us still have the custom of ladies first. So I'll do ladies first in talking about matriarchs and patriarchs. And I want to talk about a few matriarchs. So let's first go to Acts, the 12th chapter. Acts, the 12th chapter. And we have a lady who from New York who went to Minneapolis and back to New York. And now we find her in the book of Acts, you know, Rhoda Morgenstern. I'm joking. We have Rhoda in the book of Acts. I'll get to her in a moment. I just wanted to kind of lighten it up a little bit. Let's go to the book of Acts and go to the time when Peter is miraculously delivered from imprisonment. I'm going to the 11th verse of Acts 12. And when Peter had come to himself, he said, "Now I know for certain that the Lord has sent his angel and has delivered me from the hand of Herod and from all the expectation of the Jewish people." His own people were after him. He had become a dissenter to the extent that he could have been killed. So when he had considered this, he came to the house of Mary, the mother of John, whose surname was Mark, where many were gathered together praying. So you see that in Christianity, prayer is an individual thing, as Jesus said in Matthew 6. Prayer is generally done privately. You enter into a private place and you pray. This is how it is. But there is a time for people to come together to pray. And particularly at a time of crisis, to come together to pray. I've been involved in situations like that, where there was a crisis in the church and we came together to pray. And it's appropriate, of course, to have services in a home. You don't necessarily always have to have a formal structure, you know, an edifice. You don't have to have an edifice complex. You can go ahead and meet in a home. And this was the home of Mary. And she was the mother of Yohanan, John, whose surname was Mark. Now, last week I talked about Mark, I believe, and I concluded, or I speculated that this John Mark was the same person as the evangelist Mark who wrote the gospel. I could be incorrect on that. Evidently, the Greek tradition is that this is a separate person. I wanted to report that this week. I've learned, as far as I know, if there's anybody out there from the Greek-speaking community who wants to give me some input, from what I'm understanding is that in the Greek-speaking world, this John Mark is considered a different person. So in that case, he becomes a name that becomes a patriarch mentioned this time. John Mark. Yohanan was his Hebrew name. Mark was his generic name. But his mother was Mary, and she was the hostess for this prayer meeting. So she was evidently a pillar in the church, a matriarch, and she should be recognized. So let's remember Mary, the mother of John Mark, the hostess of this prayer meeting when Peter was imprisoned. And let's remember Mary as one of the matriarchs. This is not a Mary that's famous. This is a less famous Mary, but it's Mary, mother of John Mark, whose home was used as a place of prayer for the Apostle Peter. And now I want to get to Rhoda. And she strikes me as maybe somebody who would have been younger, but you know, we'll see. Maybe she was a younger woman, it would seem. And as Peter knocked at the door of the gate, a girl named Rhoda came to answer. When she recognized Peter's voice, because of her gladness, she did not open the gate, but ran in and announced that Peter stood before the gate. This is such a funny episode, and it does show God's sense of humor. As we come to the Purim season a month from now, we have to realize that God has a sense of humor. You look at some of the creations. Look at the platypus. It takes a sense of humor, I think, to create a platypus. As far as I understand, when the platypus was first sent from Australia to England, the scientists there thought it was some kind of joke that somebody had put this concoction together. It couldn't be a real animal. But in any case, she was so excited, you'd think she'd open the door for the man. But no, she runs in and says, "Peter's out there!" Well, he's still out there. Let him in. You know, but that's not what she did. She ran. When she recognized Peter's voice, because of her gladness, she did not open the gate, but ran in and announced that Peter stood before the gate. But they said to her, "You're beside yourself." Well, what kind of faith is that? They are there praying for him. Prayer does make a difference. You know, I heard about a case, maybe you read about it, in Missouri. I wasn't necessarily going to talk about it, but I'm kind of compelled to do so. There was a young man in Missouri recently who was thought to be dead. He had fallen through the ice. You probably know the story. It was in the papers. I don't read papers. What do we call it? It was on the internet, where I read my news now. And on my phone. Anyway, he had fallen into very cold water, and he was. They tried and tried to revive him, and they figured he was dead. They pretty much wrote him off. But his mother prayed, and he revived there. And to me, it's a miracle. And the mother looks at it as answered prayer. And you could read about it if you want to Google it or try to find it. Happened in Missouri a few days ago. And the mother prayed, and the son came back to life. Now, prayer does make a difference. But in this case, they were praying for Peter, but yet when he showed up, they thought, no, that can't be. When she recognized Peter's voice because of her gladness, she did not open the gate, but ran in and announced that Peter stood before the gate. And they said to her, "You are beside yourself." But she kept insisting that it was so. So they said, "It is his angel." Well, if you can believe there's an angel outside, why can't you believe that Peter's outside? That's interesting in itself. That's also kind of funny. Now, Peter continued knocking. So here she is saying, "Peter's out there." "No, he isn't." "Yes, he is. It's his angel. But meantime, let me in." So now Peter continued knocking, and when they opened the door and saw him, they were astonished. But motioning to them with his hand to keep silent, he declared to them how the Lord had brought him out of the prison. And he said, "Go tell these things to James and to the brethren." And he departed and went to another place. So Rhoda is to be commended as an enthusiastic member of the church at that time who told the truth. She was doubted. She had the faith that the others perhaps lacked. Perhaps one of the youngest there, and more faith than a lot of the elders. Rhoda is therefore one of the matriarchs that I want to talk about. I want to talk about Mary, the mother of John Mark, and also I want to acknowledge Rhoda. Who let Peter in that night from the prison there, where he would have been facing death, allowed him to enter the assembly. I want to go now to Romans, the 16th chapter. Romans, the 16th chapter, and talk about another woman in the church named Phoebe. Paul writes about her to the church at Rome in the 16th chapter of Romans. I commend to you Phoebe, our sister, who is a servant of the church in Centuria. Now, servant, of course, diakonos is the Greek. She was a deacon in the church. Now, does this mean a servant in general? It could very well mean that. Or it could be she held an office, that she was a deacon. I can at least use this as justification to have female deacons in the church. I don't think that I'm, you know, stretching to do that. So if our church gets larger and some women qualify to be deacons, I would feel I could ordain them deacons. And what does he say about Phoebe here? It says that you may receive her, verse 2, in the Lord in a manner worthy of the saints, and assist her in whatever business she has need of you. For indeed she has been a helper of many and of myself also. So I think the word helper there implies a kind of patron. Is that the right term for, did you say patroness? I don't know, a patron, patroness, one who has helped people out. So perhaps she was a woman of some means. I kind of get the idea that maybe she was a widow and maybe had some means and was able to help people out. And she was a matriarch, a pillar of the church. She was a kind of motherly figure. I'm speculating that she was a kind of matriarch, motherly figure of the church there. Perhaps her husband had been prominent in the church. Maybe he had been an elder. I'm speculating. There's a woman that comes to mind in our community who's playing a role like that. So anyway, I want to acknowledge, you know, tip off the hat metaphorically to Phoebe, who was a servant and helper. And those terms may have a lot more powerful meaning than just simply generically a servant and a helper. She may have been a, you know, had a title and an office in that congregation there in Rome. I want to now go to patriarchs, and I want to mention, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, sisters and brothers, listeners and viewers, although I realize that if you are listening, you're also viewing, because the only way you're going to listen to this and not see it is if you do it later. But some of you are. Some of you are hearing this and not seeing it because you're waiting. Okay, fine. That's fine. You know, I want you to listen rather than not, you know. So the point I'm mentioning is that the church in modern times is often under pressure, often under legal pressure. And it was ever thus, isn't that? There's a saying like that, 'twas ever thus. You know, the more things change, the French say, the more they are the same. And in ancient times, there were times when people brought legal battles against the church. This was back in the during the Persian period when the Jews wanted to rebuild their temple. There were those who brought legal challenges to stop it or delay it. You can read about that in the book of Ezra and so on. But in modern times, Christianity in general has been under pressure. Now, quite frankly, right now Christianity is literally under physical pressure. I would say, you know, I'm asking you, I'm urging you to pray for Saeed Abedini, who's in prison in Iran. His family is here in America, but he's in prison in Iran. Why? Because he's a Christian pastor. He had been born a Muslim. But becoming a Christian, if you're a Muslim in Iran, could get you killed. Right now he's been in prison, but he's been roughly treated. And I would certainly hope and pray that he'll be out of there. But this is the way this is the way it is in the world for Christians in many places. And as you know, martyrdom is now back in style, as it were, historically. It's just horrific. This is the 21st century. This is 2015. But yet we once again are seeing people martyred because they're Christian. It's incredible. But anyway, to get back to the main thrust, forgetting the really horrific martyrdom, but there are often legal challenges. It kind of reminds me of a story that I've told before, and you're tired of hearing it. But I lived through this, you know. Mm-hmm. I lived through this in the 1960s. I'm a baby boomer. So I lived through the transition when this country went from a kind of moderately religious country to a much more secular country. and there, and there's a story, a bunch of guys, little boys are in the men's room and they're kind of huddled together on the floor in a group. And the teacher goes over to them and says, "What's going on here?" And the guy says, "Oh, we're playing dice." And so the teacher says, "Oh, that's okay. I thought you were praying." And I was there in the 1960s when the situation changed. I used to go to class every day, and my teacher, you know, my homeroom teacher, I never had him for a class, but I had him for homeroom for 4 years. His last name was Bell. I don't know whatever happened to the man, but Mr. Bell, I guess, wanted to be a Shakespearean actor, or fancied himself a Shakespearean actor, and he taught English, although I never had him as an instructor. He was very kind to me, though. But anyway, Mr. Bell used to read us from the book of Proverbs because, as I said, he fancied himself a dramatic actor. And he would read to us from the book of Proverbs every morning. Of course, we would have the so-called, you know, the Lord's Prayer, Matthew 6. We would do Matthew 6 every morning. And then we would have I forget which came first. Of course, we had the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag. Well, as you know, the Supreme Court ruled that you know, we couldn't have the opening prayer anymore. So that ended, and the Bible reading also ended. So now all we had was the Pledge of Allegiance. I think at times he read us poetry. I think I do remember hearing some secular poems from the man. So maybe that's what he did, but I don't think he did it every day. But we did still have the Pledge of Allegiance. You know, but people are even challenging that. Because the original Pledge of Allegiance was, as far as I know, I think it was written by a socialist. And it wasn't it wasn't religious initially. But what happened was, during World War II, the communists decided, well, you know, now that Russia's invaded, you know, we've got to become very super patriotic Americans. And we've got to, you know, America's got to go to war to save Stalin. You know, all the communists became super hawks overnight. And then they became very patriotic Americans when America went to war. And so the communists began reciting the Pledge of Allegiance. Well, some people were kind of offended by that. So they put in "One Nation Under God." That made it more awkward for a communist to pledge allegiance. But under the Eisenhower administration, I remember, I'm that old. I'm that old. I remember when the Pledge of Allegiance added "One Nation Under God." I still remember that. It came in the 50s. Now, of course, it's been this way for many, many years. One nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. But now there are people challenging that. There are people who are feeling awkward about that. And sometimes you hear people saying it without the "under God" part. Very important, you know, key figures in our culture sometimes somehow want to leave it out. Kind of sad. But anyway, the point I'm bringing out finally, and I'm finally getting to it, is that what's very important for Christians is to have the legal experts to defend of religious freedom. And a lot of the great battles for you know, in terms of Christianity and the wider culture, are fought in the courtroom. So attorneys have become very important. Legal departments have become very important. And organizations, I don't want to mention names because I don't want to be partisan, but there are certain organizations that specialize in religious liberty cases. Well, we have an attorney mentioned in the Bible. I want to go to Titus 3. And so you see, even back then, you know, Paul mentioned this man. Now, evidently one reason he did it was perhaps to differentiate who he's talking about. But in Titus, the third chapter, and verse 13, "Send Zenas the lawyer." This is Titus 3:13. "Send Zenas the lawyer and Apollos on their journey." Everybody's heard of Apollos, I think, in this audience. But I don't know how many of you have heard of Zenas the lawyer. "Send Zenas the lawyer and Apollos on their journey with haste, that they may lack nothing." So Apollos was very critically important to the church, but so was Zenas. And he's identified here as a lawyer. And what kind of lawyer? You know, was he an expert in halachic law, Jewish law? Was he what we call a posek hadin? More than likely, I would say he was probably one who knew secular law very well, who knew Roman law very well, and therefore could really be of assistance to the church. So I want to, again, remind us that we have a patriarch of the church, Zenas the lawyer, mentioned by name by the Apostle Paul in his letter to Titus in Titus 3:13. And now I would like to go to one last patriarch. I have mentioned three matriarchs. I've mentioned Mary, the mother of John Mark. Well, actually, no, there's one more matriarch I want to mention. I don't want to skip her. So let me go back and mention one more matriarch, and that's in Acts 16. Acts, the 16th chapter. And here we have the first member of the church in Philippi, a woman named Lydia. I want to talk today about Lydia. Let's go to verse 12 of Acts 16. And from there to Philippi, I know I'm breaking into a thought, which is the foremost city of that part of Macedonia, a colony. It was established as a Roman colony. And we were staying in that city for some days. And on the Sabbath day, we went out of the city to the riverside where prayer was customarily made. So it would seem that there wasn't that much of a Jewish community there. They didn't have a building where they met, but they just gathered together by the river there. Those who were either Jewish or sympathetic, you know, people who fearers of God, you know, Gentiles who sympathized, who wanted instruction in the law. They weren't necessarily converts to Judaism, but they were those who were following along, you know, coming to synagogue for instruction. In this case, they were coming to the riverside to pray. And on the Sabbath day, we went out of the city to the riverside where prayer was customarily made, and we sat down and spoke to the women who met there. So it was a group of women meeting there. Perhaps the men did meet in the synagogue and the women went to the river. Maybe that's how they did it. Maybe the synagogue was kind of small, and so they couldn't have a separate section for the women. So the men came there and the women went to the riverside. Maybe that's how it was done. Verse 14. Now a certain woman named Lydia heard us. She was a seller of purple from the city of Thyatira, who worshipped God. So she was one who was coming along. I don't think she may not have been a convert to Judaism, but she was one who worshipped the God of the Bible. The Lord opened her heart to heed the things spoken by Paul. So she did come around and became, you know, convinced of the new covenant. And when she and her household were baptized, we ended up right by the riverside, very handy. And when she and her household were baptized, she begged us, saying, "If you have judged me to be faithful to the Lord, come to my house and stay." So she persuaded us. So she was a person of means, and she was very hospitable. And so she actually insisted that they stay with her. So here was a woman who certainly had that characteristic, which goes back to Abraham, of hospitality. And she was baptized, her household were baptized, and then she asked the apostles to, the group that, you know, it was Paul and some others to stay with her. And she persuaded us, you know, she really wanted them to do it. Very hospitable woman. And you find that after, again, a miraculous freeing from prison, if you come to the end of the chapter, once they were Paul and Silas, I believe, are in prison here, and they're dramatically rescued, you know, by God. Excuse me. So we go to verse 40. I'll have myself some water. Not enough to be baptized in, but enough to drink. And in verse 40, so they went out of the prison and entered the house of Lydia. So they went back, you know, after they came out of prison, they went back to Lydia. And when they had seen the brethren, they encouraged them and departed. So we have Lydia, a matriarch of the church, and the first convert in Philippi. So the church builds from that group of women that go by the riverside. And of course, as you know, the church is typified in the Bible by a woman. So it makes sense for the first member to be a woman. I think you often find that to be the case when the church starts somewhere, it starts with a woman. I'd like to go to Acts, the 7th chapter, if our graphics person can put Acts 7 on the screen. Acts 7. I'd like to make one last comment as you're going to Acts 7 about Lydia, because I'm going to stretch things a little bit. This is what you might call midrash, taking the scripture and kind of stretching it legitimately. But kind of stretching it a little bit. In the book of Revelation, there's a prophecy of the church at Thyatira. Remember that Lydia worked with fabric, worked with probably with garments or with tapestry. You know, she worked with purple dye. So she was in the, I guess you could say, the textile business in a way. She was a dyer, one who worked with dyes. And she came from Thyatira to Philippi. Now, later on, there was a congregation in Thyatira, which is talked about in Revelation 2 and 3, the seven churches of Revelation, and the fourth is Thyatira. And I believe that is prophetic of the of God's church in the Middle Ages. And I believe that if you were looking for God's church in the Middle Ages, where you would go is to the people that historians label Waldensians. If you were looking for God's church in the Middle Ages, that's where I believe you would go, to the Waldensian communities. And it's interesting, if you study medieval history, that in southern Germany, a significant number of Waldensians were came from the weaver trade. They were weavers of woolen, of wool. And so it's kind of interesting. They were, in a sense, working with textiles, working with materials that you could use either for clothing or for other uses, perhaps for, you know, blankets and coverings and so on. But it's kind of interesting that Lydia came from Thyatira and worked with dyes. And then later on in history, the church that Thyatira typifies had a significant number of people who had a similar trade. I think that's interesting, and I find that worth mentioning. So take it for what it's worth. I think that's interesting. I want to now go where all of you are, because you're probably looking at the screen and see Acts 7. And I want, this is our final hero for today, and that is Stephen. I believe Stephanos in Greek is crown. So he possibly had the name Katriel in Hebrew. My crown is God, or crown of God. You know, I wanted to go into it at greater length, and I guess I will. The word in Hebrew for crown, numerically equals 620. The word keter, the word for crown in Hebrew, keter, you could spell it K-E-T-H-E-R, keter, equals 620 numerically. Kaf is 20, tav is 400, and resh is 200. Is everybody still with me?
Mm-hmm.
620. And it's interesting, I think if you go to Exodus 20, I believe is where you find this, and you come to the Ten Commandments, and you find 600, I think it's, is it 620 words or 620 letters? Is possible? Are there 620 words? That may be too many. I'm not going to count them right now. But it's either 620 words or 620 letters.
For what?
For the Ten Commandments. I think it's probably 620 letters. And so the Ten Commandments, therefore, are called by Hebrew speakers, Keter Torah, the crown of the law. Kind of interesting. There are 620 letters.
Letters.
Yeah, 620 letters in the Ten Commandments, and that equals in Hebrew keter, crown. So the Ten Commandments are called the crown of the law. Now, if you should ever wander into a synagogue, as the Apostle Paul sometimes did, although he didn't wander in, he went in deliberately because he had an agenda. But if you happen to visit a synagogue, you'll find that the scrolls of the law are covered with a very nice cover to protect them, and on that cover you'll see the tablets of the law, the Ten Commandments, the Decalogue, and they're usually numbered 1 to 10, Aleph, Bet, Gimel, Dalet, Hey, Vav, you know, Chet, Tet, Yud. And then on top, there'll be a crown. On top of those tablets, those two tablets of the Ten Commandments, there'll be a crown, and you'll see the word Keter Torah. So you can check me out sometime. If you ever go to a synagogue and look at the scroll, and look at the cover on the scroll, the ornamental covering, that protects the scroll, you'll see, as I said, the Decalogue, and then the crown, and Keter Torah. And this goes back to the fact that Ten Commandments are called the crown of the law. Well, let's now talk about this man whose name was Crown, evidently, Stephanos. Let's go to 7. I don't have a lot of time to talk about him, so I want to just say a few things about Stephen today. There's a lot to learn from his very long dissertation here, and I doubt this is all of it, but it's summarized here. But he had the opportunity. He could have perhaps been very tactful and diplomatic and maybe not been martyred, but evidently he was inspired to really go full blast. Remember, Jesus Christ in Matthew 23, you know, he really went all out in condemning the leadership, the spiritual leaders of his day. And he was, of course, martyred. Well, there are times to be very tactful and careful. But this was one of those times where God inspired Stephen to just really let it out there and expose the leadership of the community for what they were. So sad, but true. And it got him killed. But in the process of doing so, there's a lot we can learn from what Stephen did. First of all, Stephen was able to just extemporaneously summarize the history of the Bible, to give the basic highlights, to go through the story. Could all of us do that? Could we do that well? Could we summarize the story flow of the Bible? Do we kind of have the general layout of it chronologically, the major figures and how it all worked out? Hopefully we could. And he did that. And of course, in the beginning, that would establish common ground with his audience. So it's important when you speak to an audience to establish common ground with your audience. As Paul says, you know, to the Jew I became as a Jew, to the Greek I became as a Greek. You want to have some way of reaching your audience and establishing common ground. So he did that. But it's interesting, he also laid the foundation for the expansion of the church. The church had started among the Jewish community there in Judea, there in Jerusalem. But remember, Jesus Christ said in Acts 1, it would go beyond that, to the Judea and Samaria, and then all over the world. So the next stop after Judea was Samaria, where you had the Samaritans, who were a mixed people. So you start with the Jews, then the next step is to go to the Samaritans, who are a mixed people. And then from there to the purely Gentiles. And Antioch, we're first called Christians at Antioch, Acts 11, in the Gentile world. So he lays the foundation for that, and he talks about the importance of the city of Shechem, modern-day Nablus, which is the center of Samaritan worship. You may recall, we're going to do more than recall it. I'm going to read about it. Let me see about Jacob here. It talks about, I guess, when they buried him. Let's go to verse 16 of Acts 7. I'll go to verse 15. Well, I want to go to verse 14 for a certain reason, because this is going to come up as a Q&A, so I may as well deal with it now. There are two versions, major versions of the Bible, that have come down to us, the Old Testament. There's the Masoretic text, the Hebrew text preserved by the Jewish community, and then there was a text in Greek that was a translation that was used by Greek-speaking Jews, which later on was replaced. The Jews replaced it because it was really too it was too sympathetic to Christian views. In other words, if you read the Septuagint, it's easier to become a Christian if you read the Old Testament in the Greek translation. And so, to kind of counteract Christian claims, the Jews retranslated the New Testament into Greek and scrapped the Septuagint. Everybody follow me? Mm-hmm. But the Septuagint was what Jews were using in the first century. And in the Septuagint, if you look at Genesis 46 and verse 20, you find that when they count the people that come into Egypt, they project a little bit into the future, and they also count four of grandchildren of Joseph and one great-grandchild. So that you have five extra people. So for some reason, the Septuagint translation not only talks about those who come into Egypt, but out of respect for Joseph, projects forward and includes his progeny in the mix. So you have 75. Whereas in the Hebrew Old Testament, 70 are counted. Five more are added, in the Septuagint version. And it's interesting that Stephen quotes from that. So once again, he's reaching out. He's reaching to the diaspora. He's reaching beyond the land of Israel, Palestine. He's reaching into the diaspora Jewish world by quoting the Septuagint version here. Is everybody okay? Nobody's confused. Okay. So in verse 14, then Joseph sent and called his father Jacob and all his relatives to him, 75 people. Okay. And let's go down to verse 15. So Jacob went down to Egypt, and he died, he and our fathers. See, it's our fathers. There's common ground there. He's talking to fellow Jews. And yet at the same time, he's quoting for the Septuagint to include in the Greek-speaking Jews. And he's also mentioning in verse 16, Shechem, which includes the Samaritans. That's their holy area. The holy area for the Jews is Jerusalem. For the Samaritans, Shechem is the holy area. And they were carried back to Shechem and laid in the tomb that Abraham bought for a sum of money from the sons of Hamor, the father of Shechem. So you see that he reaches out. He reaches out to the diaspora. He reaches out to the Samaritans. So he's laying the groundwork for the growth of the church, even as he's preparing for his own martyrdom. But then he also comes up with a way to explain to the Jews the nature of Jesus Christ. This is something that always perplexed me. How can one explain to a devout Jewish audience the nature of Jesus Christ? And the way we explain it is by understanding, you know, that in a book of John, we have John using the term logos, which a Jewish philosopher used in Egypt. The Jewish community of Alexandria was very significant in the first century. And they had a philosopher named, who we call Philo. And Philo lived at the end of the first century BC and beginning of the first century AD. And he talked about the Logos. And the book of John picks up on that and says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God. The Word was God. The Word was divine. And he talks about how God created through the Word. So we have God existing as the source of the Word. And so that we have God existing in more than one way. There's only one God, but as we know, he's God in three ways: Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. You read the book of Acts, you see the activity of the Holy Spirit very prominently. And the Logos can be understood if we go back to the Old Testament and read about Malach Yahweh, Malach Adonai, the angel of the eternal. Because there are times when God communicates directly, but by becoming his own messenger. He comes in the form of the angel of the eternal. In other words, God the communicator, God the spokesperson, God the Word. It's God, but in that form. And so the Christian translations that you have, most of you, capitalize angel. When it talks about the angel of the eternal, and it's actually God communicating, they interpret it and put a capital A there to sort of, you know, hammer home the point that here we're talking about the Logos. And you know where the Logos first appears? Where do you think? To a Gentile woman servant. How do you like that? The Logos first appears to an Egyptian female slave. So put that in your tea and drink it. Genesis 16. Here is Hagar running from Sarah. Genesis 16. The angel of the eternal said to her, "Return to your mistress and submit yourself under her hand." Then the angel of the eternal said to her, "I will multiply your descendants." What? Because this is God talking. "I will multiply your descendants exceedingly so that they shall not be counted for multitude." And we can go on and on. Let's go to verse 13. Then she called the name of Yahweh who spoke to her. See, there's only one God, Yahweh, but this is Yahweh the communicator. This is Yahweh who spoke to her. And so she called him, "You are the God who sees." For she said, "Have I also seen him who sees me?" You know, in other words, I actually have seen God and lived. Remember how Jacob was so impressed that he had seen God and lived. So he called the name of the place Peniel, the face of God, in Genesis 32. Therefore, the well was called Beer Lahai Roi. Look in your margin. Well of one who lives and sees me. And the Bible says, observe, it is between Kadesh and Bered. You see, this is a historical event. It tells you in Moses' time where the well is. So this is the appearance of God as the angel of the eternal. God as God, the communicator, the Word, the Logos. And all through the Bible, we have God communicating in this form. Theophanies, appearances of God as the angel of the eternal. Let me give you one more because it's important for this talk. Exodus 3. In Exodus 3, in verse 1, "Now Moses was tending the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the back of the desert and came to Horeb, the mountain of God." So here we're on Sinai now. "And the angel of the eternal appeared to him in a flame of fire from the midst of a bush. So he looked, and behold, the bush was burning with fire, but the bush was not consumed." A miracle. Then Moses said, I will now turn aside and see this great sight, why the bush does not burn. So when the Eternal saw that he turned aside to look, God called him from the midst of the bush. Oh, think about that. Who was in the midst of the bush? Malach Adonai, the angel of the Eternal. And now it says, God called him from the midst of the bush. And he said, Moses, Moses. And he said, here I am. Okay? And keep reading. So God spoke to him, but God spoke to him as God the Word, God the Communicator, Malach Adonai. And so you can, to an open-minded devout Jew, to an open-minded devout Jew, you can make the point. This Malach Adonai became Jesus Christ. This is the pre-incarnate Jesus Christ. And that's what Stephen was doing here in Acts 7 if you read through it. And I came across, this hit me back in the 90s when I was at USC, I believe, is when it first came to me. When I was wrestling with the nature of God issue, I wrestled with it for a lot of my life. I had to wrestle with the nature of God issue. Well, let me go to Acts 7 and verse 36. Wrong. I want to go far, or going to go back, way back, sorry. Acts 7 and verse 29, even verse 30. By the way, another thing he was doing. You see, I'm trying to tell you about how the beauty of this talk by Stephen, how much is here. One of the other things he did was he showed them their own nature, their own history, how they were constantly rejecting the truth and their own leaders and persecuting God's spokespeople. That's the history of ancient Israel, persecution of the prophets. And Moses himself had a lot of opposition. And Moses, as you know, is a type of Christ. In fact, Stephen talks about that. And if you go back to Exodus, to Deuteronomy 18, Moses prophesied about Jesus Christ in Deuteronomy 18. And that was one very important part of my teenage years when I saw that in Deuteronomy 8. Now, look, I wrestled with this for a lot of years. I went all the way into the yeshiva world. I became ultra orthodox, you know, and I went as far as you can as far as you can go in ultra orthodoxy before I finally came to my point where I had to make a decision, which I made in March of 1968. But you know, I went all the way as far as you could go. But in the meantime, as early as my teenage years, I saw Deuteronomy 18. It was pointed out to me. Don't get me wrong. I didn't have some, you know, I didn't have some visit from an angel or something. I mean, I saw somebody, you know, I had to read something. Somebody had to tell me this, obviously. So I read and I understood that Deuteronomy 18 was a prophecy of Jesus Christ, which Stephen points out. And so Moses was a type of Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ was an anti-type of Moses, and they had constantly been rejecting Moses. Now, of course, he's greatly revered in the Jewish community, and one of the 13 cardinal principles of Judaism is, you know, Lo kam b'Yisrael kemoshe od navi umabid et emunato. There's been nobody like Moses. You know, Moses is as good as it gets. Even to this day, 2015, the Jews will say in their synagogues, you know, there's been nobody like Moses. But during his lifetime, as you know, he had a lot of aggravation. And that's pointed out here by Stephen. So what he was trying to show them is, wait a minute, you know, back off. Well, how you're treating us, how you're treating me, that's how you treated other righteous people who try to tell you the truth. Now, of course, he didn't get through then. Anyway, I'm going to go to verse 30 now, Acts 7:30. And when 40 years had passed, an angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire in a bush in the wilderness of Mount Sinai. But it wasn't just an angel of the Lord. It was really God himself in that form. When Moses saw it, he marveled at the sight, and as he drew near to observe, the voice of the Lord came to him. Well, if the angel was there, what was the angel doing there? God was speaking to him, so what was the angel doing there? Because that's how God was speaking to him. This is the pre-incarnate Jesus Christ. And you can read now for the rest of it. Let's go to verse 35. This Moses whom they rejected, saying, who made you a ruler and a judge? You know, he had all these problems with the congregation, as you know. This Moses, whom they rejected, saying, "Who made you ruler and judge?" is the one God sent to be a ruler and a deliverer by the hand of the angel who appeared to him in the bush. And that is the very being who became incarnated, whom you conspired with the Roman authorities to have killed recently. You know, he's saying this not that long after it happened. Everybody still with me on this? So it's a very powerful message. And of course, then he really lowered the boom on them and finally was martyred. And it's just a horrific thing to read about. But yet, you know, in our modern times, these kinds of things are happening again in that same part of the world. Verse 57, as well as elsewhere, for that matter. But I'm in Acts 7 and verse 55. Acts 7, 55. This is a great patriarch, a great hero of the one of the founding fathers of the church, Stephen, who was a deacon. I should have mentioned that. If you go back to Acts 6, he was one of the first seven deacons ordained. But I think a lot of you know that. But just to remind everybody, if you go back to Acts 6, he was one of the first seven deacons ordained. Anyway, back in verse, now I'm going to go to 7:55. But he, being full of the Holy Spirit, gazed into heaven and saw the glory of God and Jesus standing at the right hand of God. So he was given a vision to show him what was happening, spiritually speaking, that this Jesus, who had been the teacher, the rabbi, was now ascending to the heavens and at the right hand of God. So to show where, you know, that Jesus was entering back into divinity. And so this is what he saw, this vision, and then he repeated it, and that got him killed. Verse 56, and said, "Look, I see the heavens opened and the Son of Man standing at the right hand of God." Well, they couldn't handle that. Then they cried out with a loud voice, stopped their ears, and ran at him with one accord. So he had tremendous courage. He didn't try to get out of this. He could have tried to get out, save his skin, as it were. But he evidently was inspired to just tell the full truth, and the consequences came to him. So he became a martyr. And they cast him out of the city and stoned him, and the witnesses laid down their clothes at the feet of a young man named Saul. Well, you know what finally happened to him. Well, just to make sure, in case some of you don't know that much about the Bible, I have no idea who's listening to me. This is the Saul who later on became the apostle, Paul. Verse 59, and they stoned Stephen as he was calling on God and saying, "Lord Jesus, receive my spirit." Now, I have looked through the Bible, and we normally pray to God, our Father who is in heaven. You know, as I talked about the so-called Lord's Prayer, we pray to God. God is our Father. And I only see two examples of direct prayer to Jesus. Now, if you find more, you can tell me. I find this one where he's about to die and he says, "Lord Jesus, receive my spirit." Now, he's making a point there. There's one other place I see it, and that's at the end of the Bible. Now, if there's some other places, you can tell me. But I only see two direct prayers to Jesus. This one by Stephen as he's about to die, and then when you get to the end of the Bible. So let's go to the very end of the Bible, pretty close. This is Revelation 22:20. "He who testifies to these things says, 'Surely I am coming quickly.' And then John says, 'Amen. Even so, come, Lord Jesus.'" So there you have it. So those are the two occasions I see where a prayer is directly to the Word rather than to God as God, but God the Word. We see a reference to a prayer to Jesus here and at the end of the Bible. Now, as I said, if you find others, please let me know. But notice the last thing he says. He realizes that their minds were dark and they didn't understand, and he gave them very heavy spiritual truth besides criticizing them, exposing the worst side of what they were. And so obviously he got them riled up, and he knew what would happen. And so he's asking God to be merciful. So this wonderful patriarch of the church, after saying, "Lord Jesus, receive my spirit," look at verse 60. "Then he knelt down and cried out with a loud voice, 'Lord, do not charge them with this sin.'" just as Jesus said, you know, forgive them for they know not what they do. You know, he's saying, you know, they have a lot of baggage and they just are not yet able to overcome. And I've really given them a full dose. You know, I've let it all out, and it was more than they could handle. And so he says, Lord, do not charge them with this sin. And when he had said this, he fell asleep. Notice how the Bible puts it. You notice Paul talks about it in the same way in his letter to the Thessalonians. For a Christian, death is like being asleep, because we have the opportunity to wake up. When Christ returns, he will awaken us who are dead, and we will be resurrected to spirit life, immortal life. So for us Christians, death is like being asleep. And so that's how it's worded here. Stephen is looking forward. Of course, he's dead now and not conscious, but as he died, his last conscious thoughts would have been looking forward to the resurrection, the return of Jesus Christ, and his rising to meet Jesus Christ. And we can be there too. We can be there with those matriarchs and patriarchs I read about today. And won't it be exciting to actually meet those people that are mentioned in the Bible here? I want to go to Hebrews 12 in conclusion. I've talked about these people so that their names are more in your mind and you remember them. Mary, the mother of John Mark, and Rhoda, and Phoebe, and Lydia, the matriarchs of the church, and Demas, the lawyer, and then, of course, Stephen, who's more, you know, perhaps the most famous of these people, that these names would be in our memory, and we would be looking forward to seeing them. And Hebrews 12 is where I want to go now, and I'm breaking into a thought. Verse 22, Hebrews 12. But you have come to Mount Zion, and to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, to an innumerable company of angels. This is where we're heading if we're members of the Church of God. To the general assembly and church of the firstborn, who are registered in heaven, to God the judge of all, to the spirits of just men made perfect. This is where we're heading. We're heading for a rendezvous with Jesus Christ and the resurrected saints. To Jesus, the mediator of the new covenant, and to the blood of sprinkling that speaks better things than that of Abel. Abel was the first martyr. Stephen was another. Jesus Christ, of course, God himself had to become a martyr for us. And there have been others, and there will be others. But whatever happens to us between now and the time we die, after our death, if we're members of the Church of God, we can look forward to the resurrection, to spirit life, to immortal life, and to share eternity with God, and to share eternity with these matriarchs and patriarchs. So let's remember these matriarchs and patriarchs. And now, drum roll, please. The Q&A section. And I'm grateful. We have quite a few questions. I can't answer them all today. So be patient. I had talked about Genesis 1:1, and evidently there's some still confusion about my explanation, so I have to explain it more clearly at a later time. I do plan to get back to that, because I found it very interesting, but some kind of found it maybe interesting but also confusing. So I'll get back to that. But I want to go to Exodus 4. Exodus 4. Well, let me go back all the way to Genesis. I may as well go logically. I'll go Genesis, Exodus. I'll do it that way. Let's go to Genesis. Let's go to Genesis 11. This is the Q&A section now. You've heard the sermon, and now we're in the Q&A part. So in Genesis 11 and verse 31, we find that Abraham's family left Ur in what is today Iraq, and went into what is today Syria, and they went to a place called Haran. We're in Genesis 11:31. And Terah took his son Abram and his grandson Lot, the son of Haran, and his daughter-in-law Sarai, his son, Abram's wife. And they went out with them from Ur of the Chaldeans to the land of Canaan, and they came to Haran, in this case the city, and dwelt there. So they came to the city of Haran. Now it so happens, if you study ancient history, the city of Haran was a center of moon worship. the moon cult was there. Now, the moon is very important in the Middle East. It's important, of course, everywhere. But in the Middle East, you know, in some parts of the Middle East, it's desert, and you're wandering around in the desert, and you don't get any rain. And so the sun is just sort of there. You kind of wish it sometimes there were less of the sun. But at night, it's cool, but the moon gives you light. The moon and stars give you light. And so you really begin to appreciate the moon, because at night it's cool and you can move around and you can go from place to place if you have the moonlight. So you tend to really be moon-centered. And, of course, the lunar calendar, the Muslim world to this day uses a purely lunar calendar. Anyway, back in those days, there was a cult of the moon, and that may be why Laban had his name. If you go to, you know, later on when Jacob comes up to his uncle is named Laban. Now, Laban means white. If you look up at the moon, that's the way the moon looks on a dark night. It looks white. And one of the Hebrew names for moon is Levana. It's called Levana. That's not the only name. But one of the names for the moon is Levana. And so Laban may have been given that name in honor of the moon god. Now, sometimes the moon is pictured as a goddess, sometimes a male deity, sometimes a female deity. But lunar shapes were used in worship, the crescent symbol. And people also wore it. They wore ornaments in honor of the moon god and also in honor of the sun god. People wore sun-shaped and moon-shaped ornaments. And that's still done by religious people today. They have these religious symbols that they wear. And people have good luck charms and amulets and things they wear. And when I was a boy, people would have a rabbit's foot and they would rub it. I don't know if that's common now, but when I was growing up, people would have a rabbit's foot. And some people have medals hanging in medallions or statuary in their vehicles, which they look upon as protection and all that sort of thing. Well, that's, of course, not God's way. You know, we look to God. We don't look to these things, these statues and ornaments. And we don't adorn ourselves with ornaments in honor of pagan gods and goddesses, you know. Excuse me. We don't have, you know, I love Artemis banners or whatever. So let's go to Genesis 35. So when they were entering the promised land, Jacob said, it's time for us to really settle down and purify ourselves and get rid of the idolatry. I think there's a term called henotheism, H-E-N-O-T-H-E-I-S-M, henotheism, which is you believe in one main god. You have other gods, but there's one who's, you know, kind of up there as the god, but there's other powers you acknowledge. And that's probably the way it was with Laban's family. They knew of Yahweh. They knew of the God of Abraham, but they hadn't totally shaken off getting involved in what was going on around them, the gods and goddesses around them. They kind of had a mixture to some degree. And in many ways today, modern religion tends to be very similar. I don't want to get into it and step on toes, but I think you'll find in many modern religions, although they claim to be monotheistic, in some ways they are almost henotheistic. I'll pick on somebody that's not going to offend very many of you. I'll pick on my own community, the ultra-Orthodox Jews, the Haredim. They will go miles. They will spend a lot of money in order to go to the grave of a tzaddik, a holy man. They'll go to the Ukraine. They'll go back to the Ukraine from Brooklyn or from Israel to go to the graves of the great Hasidic rabbis of the Ukraine. It's good for the Ukrainians. You know, they make money. It's good for tourism. But these rabbis will go and pray at the graves of these tzaddikim because they think somehow if they pray at the grave of the tzaddik, somehow the tzaddik, because they believe that the tzaddik is immortal, that his soul is in paradise. Okay, so they believe his soul is in paradise. So they go to the grave of the tzaddik and they pray there. That's not something that everybody would endorse, but it's a popular custom among the Hasidic Jews. So I'll pick on them because I don't think that many of them are listening, but I could pick on other people too if I wanted to. So as I said, even nowadays, although religions claim to be monotheistic, they're not really purely monotheistic in many cases. So here we have Jacob in Genesis 35. And Jacob said to his household and to all who were with him, put away the foreign gods that are among you. Purify yourselves and change your garments. Let's have a new start. Get rid of all these pagan ornamentations that you're wearing. You know, these trinkets and good luck charms and amulets and idolatrous symbols. Verse 4. So they gave Jacob, this is verse 4 of Genesis 35, all the foreign gods which were in their hands, and the earrings which were in their ears, and Jacob hid them under the terebinth tree which was by Shechem. I talked about Shechem earlier. Stephen talked about it. So anyway, they buried this material, including earrings. So evidently these were earrings that were pagan symbols. Perhaps they were lunar-shaped earrings for the moon god or the moon goddess. All right, so they got rid of those earrings. So let's keep that in mind, that idolatry does not just refer to statuary, but it can also refer to various charms and amulets and symbols and that people wear, which deflect them from the true God, which distract them from true monotheism. All right, now one more question I'd like to deal with today, and that's in Exodus 4. Exodus 4. And remember that in Exodus 4, I talked about this last week. Moses is going back to Egypt. God is going to use him to redeem his people. And Moses goes to his father-in-law. Moses 4:18. So Moses went and returned to his... Remember, we were just talking about Moses at the burning bush. So Moses went and returned to Jethro, his father-in-law, and said to him, please let me go and return to my brethren who are in Egypt and see whether they are still alive. And Jethro said to Moses, go in peace. Now the Eternal said to Moses, I'll keep reading. Now the Eternal said to Moses in Midian, go, return to Egypt, for all the men who sought your life are dead. Keep that in mind. Remember, he was in the wilderness 40 years. People tend to forget that. He was 80 when he came back. Now, not like you see in most of the Hollywood versions. He was gone 40 years. He came back at the age of 80. Verse 20. He left when he was 40. Verse 20. Then Moses took his wife and his sons and set them on a donkey, and he returned to the land of Egypt. You see, he was the kind of man who would put his wife and kids on a donkey, and, you know, that's what you do, right? Then Moses took his wife and his sons and set them on a donkey and returned to the land of Egypt, and Moses took the rod of God in his hand. Now, there was an episode about circumcision that I talked about last week. But now let's go to Exodus 18. Now, I don't believe, personally, that circumcision episode was where Zipporah went back. I don't think so. I think that may have been the way I talked about it last week, the opposite. It may have been a way of her committing herself to be with Moses' people. But let's say Moses now does come back, you know, with the Israelites. They've crossed the Red Sea. The Egyptian army has drowned. Now they're in the Sinai Peninsula, and they're heading for Mount Sinai. So they're in the region where Moses had been before, where Jethro was the priest of Midian. And so Moses probably told Zipporah and the children, you go on ahead and tell your dad what's been happening. Go visit my father-in-law with the children. And then as we get closer to him, he can come back and bring you back. That's what I think happened. I think probably once they crossed the Red Sea, got back into Sinai, they were near enough to her family that he told her, go on ahead and visit your family. And then as we get closer, we can come on back together. That's what I think happened. That's my spin on it. So let's go to Exodus 18. And Jethro, the priest of Midian, Moses' father-in-law, heard of all that God had done for Moses and for Israel, his people, that the Eternal had brought Israel out of Egypt. So Jethro was not there. Jethro was back in Midian. He was not there with Moses. The father-in-law didn't go to Egypt. I got that question recently, but no. Jethro, you know, was there in Midian. Then Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, took Zipporah, Moses' wife, after he had sent her back, with her two sons, of whom the name of one was Gershom, for he said, I have been a stranger in a foreign land. And the name of the other was Eliezer, for he said, the God of my father was my help, and he delivered me from the sword of Pharaoh. And Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, came with his sons and his wife to Moses in the wilderness, where he was encamped at the mountain of God. I believe that if you were to go to synagogue this Sabbath, this is the portion of the law that they're reading. They're reading this section, and they'll be reading about the Ten Commandments this week in the synagogues. Now, I'm ahead of them. I decided I wasn't going to just try to go week by week with a portion of the week, but I would try to get through Deuteronomy, get through the Pentateuch as quickly as I could. So I'm around Deuteronomy 14 or so, as I recall, as I'm reading through the Pentateuch. And I know that I just heard from somebody last night that she was in Deuteronomy. Anyway, in verse 6, so wherever you are, don't feel, if you're keeping up with the Jews week by week, that's fine. You'll finish by next autumn, by this coming autumn, so that's fine. And this week, if you're keeping up with the Jews, you're reading this portion that I'm reading here. Now he had said to Moses, I, your father-in-law Jethro, am coming to you and with your wife and her two sons with her. So Moses went out to meet his father-in-law, bowed down and kissed him, and they asked each other about their well-being, and they went into the tent. You see the importance of family in the Bible. It's brought out in many ways, in many places. And Moses told his father-in-law all that the Eternal had done to Pharaoh and to the Egyptians for Israel's sake, and all the hardship that had come upon them on the way, and how the Eternal had delivered them. Then Jethro rejoiced for all the good which the Eternal had done for Israel, whom he had delivered out of the hand of the Egyptians. And Jethro said, now remember, Jethro was not in the same situation as Moses, but now he was beginning to really understand the God of Moses. And Jethro said, blessed be Yahweh, right? The God of Israel. He had some awareness, but now he has much greater awareness. And Jethro said, blessed be the Eternal who has delivered you out of the hand of the Egyptians and out of the hand of Pharaoh, and who has delivered the people from under the hand of the Egyptians. Now I know that the Eternal is greater than all the gods. For in this very, from the very thing in which they behaved proudly, he was above them. So he was greater than the greatest empire in the world and all the gods and goddesses that they worshipped. He plagued them all and punished them all and overcame them all. You know, this is a very wonderful moment for the family, you know, for Jethro to acknowledge this. So I would hope that this would answer the question that came on this. Before I conclude today, I do have some prayer requests. And I want to tell you, prayer does make a difference. I had a neighbor, Gary, who was quite ill, and I asked you to pray for him. And he's supposed to come home from the hospital tomorrow. Evidently, he was sufficiently recovered. Those of you who have some awareness of the situation in Florida, in this area, Orlando, in Celebration, he was at the ORMC, I'm trying to remember what that stands for. Orlando, Orange Regional Medical Center, maybe Orange County Regional Medical Center. He was at ORMC. And then they sent him to a nicer facility run by the Seventh-day Adventists, where you go if you're not quite as in so much trouble. They sent him there for rehab. They sent him to the hospital at Celebration. And now we hear that tomorrow he's supposed to come home. So thank you for your prayers for my neighbor, Gary. Please continue to pray now for his full recovery. I would also like to ask that you continue to pray for Pat Bohannon. We're not entirely sure what her problem is. She did have a health issue that she's dealing with, and she needs to know more about what it is so she can deal with it more effectively. So we ask your continued prayers for Pat Bohannon. And now I'd like to also mention a man for whom I used to work, and I have been taught by him, and he's had a big influence on my life, and that's Ron Dart, an evangelist in the church. He has severe problems right now with illness. Of course, he's getting on in years. Interestingly, he was born when the media effort began that probably brought most of you into God's church. He was born on January 7th, 1934. So what does that make him? That made him 81 this year, right? That made him 81 this year. His wife Allie has asked for our prayers for his recovery. So please pray for Ron Dart. And then we have one more prayer for a member of our own congregation, and that is Lil Drattler. She's having some health issues, so please pray for Lil Drattler's complete recovery. Now I have some very positive news to talk about in terms of the church. You know, we always like to gather people together for the holy day seasons, and last year during the spring, we went out to Northern California, and some people came up from Southern California to be with us. Well, this year, we're hosting the spring festival season here in Central Florida, and we do have some people coming from Southern California to join us here, and we're very excited about it. And so we want to extend a welcome, Matt. It's not too late to make your plans. We're around the middle of the 11th month, so we have, you know, a couple of months. You can make your plans and come on down here for the New Testament Passover, for the night to be much observed, and perhaps the first day of unleavened bread, which is a weekly Sabbath this year. And then you have Sunday where you can still go on back to your responsibilities. So by Monday morning, you can be, you know, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed for whatever you have to do. But the more the merrier. Come on down. And we're certainly grateful to have visitors coming from Southern California for the spring festival season this year. So in the meantime, all the best to you and yours.